All right, so take your notes, if you would, and you might take your Bibles and turn to Ruth. We're making our way through the Old Testament, taking a look at every book of the Old Testament at a very high level, trying to give you kind of an overview of the book, where it's situated in the canon of Scripture and the biblical storyline. And my responsibility this week and next week is to cover Ruth, 1st and 2nd Samuel. Okay, so a lot of material. It hasn't been that long ago, by the way, that I preached through Ruth, and it wasn't that much long ago before that that I preached through 1st and 2nd Samuel. We talked about Samuel, Saul, and David in that series that we did. So this should be familiar territory to, I think, everybody that's here. Take a look at your handout, and I'm sorry, when I copied this, I did two-sided, but you'll notice the back side is upside down. So if you were looking at the front side, and by that, you got the little logo over on your right-hand side, look to the left side of the page. And there are some major dates of Old Testament events that are there. Last week, we talked about the time of the Judges, which is a 350-year period of time. Stretches from 1390 B.C. to roughly 1050 B.C., when Saul is crowned king. He is king for 40 years. And then David rules for another 40 years, and then Solomon comes on the scene at 970. So that's the time period that we happen to be in as we're going to be studying this particular book. All right, so if I said to you, who is the major personality, the most important person in these books, who would you say? David. Why do we have the book of Ruth in the Bible? So imagine that you're a brand new Christian, right? You really have never studied the Bible, read the Bible. I mean, you know some of the things that are in it. You're familiar with some of the names, but otherwise, you just don't know much about the Bible itself. So somebody gives you a Bible, you're a brand new Christian, you open it up to Genesis and you start reading. You know, and Genesis is kind of interesting. Exodus is very interesting. Leviticus, it kind of bogs down a little bit in Leviticus. Numbers kind of picks up again. Then you get into Deuteronomy and all those laws and things kind of slow down again. Then you get into Joshua and you read about the conquest of the land of Canaan and it's exciting. You get into Judges and it gets really interesting. Because as we talked about last week, the time of Judges is a time of moral anarchy. You don't really have a nation. What you have is a loose confederation of tribes. And some of those tribes don't get along with other tribes. And there is inter-warfare that takes place. Some of those tribes are out on the boundaries of the Promised Land, very close to other Canaanite nations. And it's not long before they get infected with the idolatry of those Canaanite nations. They start intermarrying with them, and problems occur. And Jeremy covered all that last week, so we're not going to go back over it. But the book of Ruth occurs at the very end of that period. Okay? So on your outline, you know, it's somewhere around maybe 1080, maybe 1100 BC in that ballpark. Okay? Now imagine that you're a new Christian and you're reading the book of Ruth, never having read it before, and you're thinking to yourself, this is a nice story. But what does it have to do with anything? I mean, why is it there? You've got this family that leave Canaan, go into exile in Moab. Husband, two sons die. Naomi is left a widow. She only has a couple of daughters-in-law. One daughter-in-law says, I will go back with you. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Don't worry, I'm going to take care of you in your old age. And you're thinking, well, this is a wonderful story, but what does it have to do with the rest of the Bible? And you keep reading in that story until you get to the very last word in the book. And what's the very last word in the book? David. David. And then you have an epiphany. You know, you go, wow. Now I get it. Ruth is the great-great-grandmother of David. And the reason that it's positioned in the book where it is, between Judges and 1 Samuel, is that it is this transition. At the very end of the book of Judges, it introduces God's answer to the anarchy of the book of Judges. And God's answer is going to be a monarchy. Anarchy is going to be replaced by monarchy. First Saul, and then, of course, David. So Ruth and 1 and 2 Samuel have a number of different characters in it, but all of them are really about David. How does David come to the throne? What kind of role does he play? It's all about that. Now, we're going to go low tech for a second this morning, and I want to show you something. Last week, Jeremy made a good point that the book of Judges is, you know, cyclical. You have a period of renewal and then sin, especially with idolatry and intermarriage. You have God's judgment. Judges sent along. There is repentance, and the cycle repeats itself over and over again. Well, the fact of the matter is, what you see in a microcosm in the book of Judges is true of the entire Old Testament, isn't it? It's a period, it's a series of peaks and valleys. So let me show you this. So, the Bible begins, should always check your markers before you try to do this. Mel, are you going to go find one for me? What a good wife. Yeah, sorry. We can throw that one away. All right. While she's doing that, think about it this way. Creation begins on a peak, right? And it's the peakiest of the peaks. Doesn't get any better than the Garden of Eden with man in perfect communion with God. Doesn't last very long. And you start to see the slide down with the disobedience of humanity. And it continues to slide down to the first trough. And then someone is said to be born. Thank you, Mel. This makes a lot better sense when you can see it instead of me just trying to describe it. Okay. So here's creation. Right? Here's the fall, and it brings us to the first trough, when God is going to bring cataclysmic judgment against the world, right? And it's going to coincide with the birth of a male son. What's his name? He finds grace in the eyes of the Lord. When the rest of the world is falling apart. No? Noah, thank you. I do that all the time too. Noah, right? Judgment comes, and humanity begins over again. Doesn't last very long. Humanity slides into rebellion again, and there is another judgment. It happens in Genesis chapter 11. What's it? Tower of Babel. Tower of Babel. And immediately after the Tower of Babel, another male child comes into the narrative. What's his name? Abraham. God makes a covenant with him. Biblical history takes an upturn. This is going to be your land. These are going to be your people. These are the things that I'm going to do for you. Doesn't last very long. There is another moment of declension in the storyline. And for 400 years, Abraham's descendants are in Egypt. And then we have the introduction of another male son. Who is his name? Yeah, this time it's Moses. Right? Moses delivers the people of Israel. They come into the conquest under Joshua. As Jeremy pointed out last week, things decline again. And at the very end of the book of Judges, four times, and this is the last verse of the book, and it's the fourth time this has been said, the biblical writer of Judges says, in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did that which was right in his own eyes. So you've got this anarchy, because there is no king in Israel. It's foreshadowing, right? It's hinting at what's coming. And what's the male child that gets introduced here? Last word in the book of Ruth, David. And there's a rise in the monarchy. Israel's restored to its fortunes. He begins to consolidate all of these loosely held tribes and brings them together. The last of which is Saul's tribe, right? Benjamin kind of brings them in. This doesn't last very long, right? At its zenith, Solomon is here. But what happens in the rest of biblical history? There's another declension. And there is no rise in the rest of the Old Testament. You get to the end of the Old Testament, 2 Chronicles, and where is Israel? Scattered. Scattered. I mean, Ezra and Nehemiah have brought back a remnant from Babylon to try to start rebuilding things again. But for the most part, the nation of Israel is just scattered to the wind. And we need another male child. And he's predicted here. And his name is Jesus. He's not named in the Old Testament, but he's talked about throughout all of the prophets. And this male child will once again restore Israel's fortune. Except Israel will get recharacterized, refitted, reformatted, and it will include you and I. Now, why the emphasis upon these male children? Because right here, immediately after the creation, when humanity falls, God says to Eve, I'm going to give you a son, and he will come forth, and the seed of the serpent will bruise his heel, but his heel will step down and crush the head of that serpent. And so as the biblical narrative goes forward, you keep waiting for the he. Is it Noah? Well, it looks like it maybe initially, and then Noah's drunk in his tent. Is it Abraham? Look at all those promises that are given to him. Then Abraham leaves the promised land, lies about Sarah being his sister. Oh, it's not Abraham. Well, maybe it's Moses. Moses is the guy, right? Born, delivered from the crocodiles in the Nile. I mean, Moses has got to be the guy, right? Oh, Moses kills a guy. Then he strikes a rock. And he does other things that disqualify him. So maybe it's David. David is this guy that's finally going to crush the head of the serpent. Oh, then you got David killing people, David having people killed, Bathsheba, the whole mess. He's a great man. He's a great king. He is a lousy father. Lousy. And so what we need is a male child that's greater than Noah, but will deliver us from judgment. Greater than Abraham, but be the true heir of those promises. Greater than Moses, but be a better deliverer, delivering us not just from physical bondage, but from the bondage of our own sin. And greater than David, a king who will be truly just, truly righteous. That's the narrative going forward of this up and down and up and down. The reason why this is true of the larger narrative is because all of the individuals in the narrative have the same peaks and valleys in their life, right? And that's why they're replaced all the time. So you have Noah, falls. Abraham comes on the scene, disobeys. Moses comes on the scene, disobeys. David comes on the scene, disobeys, and so forth. This cycle that you see in Judges is the cycle that repeats itself all the way through the Old Testament. And it's in that cycle that Ruth appears. Ruth is this wonderful story of a people who, like Abraham's descendants, Israel, his 12 sons, all of their family, leave the promised land. And for the same reason, why did Joseph have his brothers and his father and all of their family come down to Egypt? What was the reason he did that? Because of a famine. Why does Naomi and her family leave the promised land? It's because of a famine. All right, so here's the way the story unfolds. The very beginning, you have this famine in the land. We're at the very end of Judges. Everybody is doing what's right in their own eyes. And it appears reasonable to Naomi and her family that in our own eyes, what we ought to do is get out of the promised land. Give up the land that God has given to us and go and live among the Moabites. All right, so you're that brand new Christian. You've been reading your way through the Bible. What do you know about the Moabites? Where did they originate? What's that? Lot. Moab was the illegitimate offspring of an incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughter. Okay? That's an ugly story. And if you're a new Christian reading through the Bible and you come across that story, you're going, oh my goodness, what in the world is this about? Why is it in there? Well, he actually has the incestuous relationship with both daughters. Both daughters conceive, give birth to children. One of them is named Moab, and the other is named Edom. Okay. When you have been reading, as this new Christian, through the Old Testament books of, let's say, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and then into Joshua and Judges, you hear the Lord say over and over and over again, don't intermarry with these people. Because if you do, their gods are going to become your gods. They're going to bring all of their pagan baggage into that marriage. Don't marry unbelievers. So when you start reading the first few verses of the book of Ruth, you're going, oh man, this can't end well. They've got two sons, and where are those sons going to ever find spouses? And sure enough, as the story goes, they marry two Moab girls, right? Ruth is one of them. So you're thinking to yourself, okay, judgment is going to come because that's been the pattern all along, right? We have been seeing this pattern. When you disobey God, judgment follows. And what is true of the nation as a whole is also true of individuals, and sure enough, judgment comes. The father dies, two sons die, and here is Ruth, an older widow, living in a world that is not her own, with two Moabite daughters-in-law. And the question has to come to your mind, is there any reversal in this story? This declension that has taken place that leaves her husbandless and childless, is there any reversal that can take place? And the story of the book of Ruth is that God's grace is greater than our sin. When we do dumb, stupid things, things that in retrospect you look back and go, what in the world was I thinking? Why did I do that? That God's graciousness, his kindness, his mercy is greater than our sin. And so he reverses the fortunes of Naomi. The book is called Ruth. The book is really about Naomi. It's about God's grace to her. God reversing the fortunes. Ruth plays a very important role in that because she's going to be the unlikely and unexpected and frankly very surprising instrument of God's mercy. To think that she deliberately goes to Moab with her husband, allows her sons to intermarry with Moabites, and then God will use a Moabite to be an instrument of his grace to her, to sustain her, to secure her. And of course, the most beautiful passage in the book of Ruth is when Ruth speaks to Naomi and says, I'm going home with you. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you live, I'm going to live. I'm going to take care of you. And so they move back to the land. And blessings start to occur. By happenstance, a very wealthy, unmarried Israelite sees a young woman out gleaning in the fields. Now, keep in mind, if this is a field, okay, this room is a field, God had told wealthy landowners, leave the edges of the field unharvested. That way, widows and orphans and people that are in need can come to your land and they can glean from the edges of the land. They can then sell the grain and they can have sustenance for them. So Boaz is a righteous man. Probably not very many farmers in Israel did that. Okay? There's nothing that indicates that the nation of Israel was full of righteous people. Remember, there's no king in Israel. Everybody does that which is right in his own eyes. But Boaz is a righteous man. And so he takes seriously the commands of God, and he leaves these strips of grain all the way around the edge of the field. So one day, he's out there with the guys that are working the inside of the field, and he sees this young lady, and he says, who's that? And they go, well, that's the daughter-in-law of your cousin Naomi, because Ruth is a kinsman to her. And he says, well, that's interesting. Yeah, she came back from Moab with Naomi. And Boaz thinks to himself, I'm surmising here because we're not told this in the text. He thinks to himself, that's really a remarkable thing for that young lady to do. I mean, if I were her, I would have stayed with my people and I would have remarried somebody. She's come with her mother-in-law into this place and is willing to live here and sustain her mother-in-law? I mean, that's a pretty remarkable thing. And as the story unfolds, and it unfolds pretty quickly. By the way, most of the narrative is just 2 days in the life of Ruth and Naomi. I don't mean two consecutive days. I just mean the narrative is around two 24-hour periods in their lives. The rest of the story goes, as you know, Boaz speaks to Ruth. Ruth comes home, tells Naomi. Naomi says, that's a good sign. And Naomi sees in these unfolding events the potential for her reversal. That this judgment that she has suffered because of her disobedience, that there is the possibility that Yahweh is going to deliver her through Boaz, the kinsman redeemer, and her daughter-in-law, Ruth. Okay. Now, I want you to go to the last chapter in Ruth. Boaz has married Ruth. The community is witness to it. And I want you to see how the blessings of God flow. First of all, there are blessings to the community at large. Look at verse 11 of chapter 4. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make this woman who is coming into your house, meaning Ruth, like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. There's the first time we have come across this important city. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Okay, so what's that story about? What's the story of Tamar and Judah and their son Perez? What is it?
She lost her husband.
Yep. Her father-in-law. Judah is her father-in-law. Tamar lost her husband. Judah has given two sons to her. Both of them have died. He's not giving a third. She is angry at that. She dresses up like a prostitute, stands on the side of the road, tempts him. He comes into her. She gets pregnant with twins. Perez is one of these twins. In other words, similar story to Lot and his daughters. And Perez is in Boaz's line. This is the unexpected, surprising, in some cases shocking, grace of God to his people. And these women recognize this. And they go, she's a Moabite. Well, guess what? Perez ultimately brought forth Boaz. And so let's celebrate God's grace. And may he build up these people the way he built Israel up through the line of Judah. Keep in mind, Bethlehem is a town in what tribe? So if there's any tribe of people that should be welcoming of a descendant of Moab, it should be the folks of Judah. Again, these marvelous peaks and valleys in the story. I have said this often, I'll say it again for those of you who haven't been around. Judah is the prodigal son of the Old Testament. Judah leaves the family, goes into a far country. He falls into a relationship with a guy named Hiram, a Canaanite. As far as we know, he adopts all of the practices of the Canaanites. He has children. He has three sons, loses two of them. He goes into a woman that he thinks is a prostitute, finds out is his daughter-in-law, and has two sons, twins, by her. You talk about a guy that has declined. And down here at the bottom of this, he finds out that he is the father of twins by a daughter-in-law that he thought was a prostitute. That's as low a trough as you were going to get, right? And then, in this remarkable story, Judah goes home. And even though he is the fourth son, when you get to the end of the book of Genesis, he's the one who is given the promises that he is going to bring forth the Messiah. There is this marvelous, marvelous scene. Forgive me for getting off on this, but it's because of this mention in the book of Ruth. There's this marvelous scene where Judah is standing before Joseph. He doesn't know Joseph is Joseph. And Joseph has intentionally had his brothers indicted on theft. Joseph, I think, is bitter. Joseph is angry. It's understandable. And he wants a pound of flesh. And so he says, "You leave Benjamin with me," which is his closest brother, right? Same mother. "You leave Benjamin with me." And who is it that speaks up? It's Judah. It's not Reuben, the oldest. It's Judah. Because Judah has been broken in this period of declension. And he stands before Joseph and he says, "You can't do that. Take me, not my younger brother. Our father will be crushed by this." And Judah's speech breaks Joseph's. He runs out of the room, he goes into the back, and he starts weeping and crying. And Judah becomes the instrument, the unlikely instrument, in Joseph's reversal and his repentance. This is God's surprising way of working. And so these women say, "Look, we're descendants of Perez here in the land of Judah. How in the world can we not accept a Moabite? May God bless her." Now notice, not only is the community restored, but Naomi is restored. Well, Ruth is, first of all. Ruth is blessed. Verse 13, "So Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her the conception, and she bore a son." So she receives blessing now. Then there's Naomi, verse 14. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be Yahweh who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." And then it ends by saying, the entire nation is going to be blessed. Because according to verse 22, Obed fathered Jesse, and Jesse fathered David. And so this loose confederation of tribes, which has undergone significant reversal from the judges, is going to have significant judgment from the time of the judges, is going to have their fortunes reversed with the birth of this king, David. Okay? That's the story of Ruth. Any questions on any of that? Arthur? Yeah, the only thing I would add to that, Arthur, is if possible, Naomi doesn't go to glean. Naomi stays home. Ruth does. That's right, Ruth. Ruth does. Ruth is doing the work for Naomi. That's exactly right. Okay, that leads us to 1 Samuel. We're just going to get through a portion of 1 Samuel, and we'll pick up this next week. Okay. So the book of 1 Samuel is really about three men. Chapters 1 through 7, it's about Samuel. And a summary of Samuel's life is given to us in chapter 7, verse 15. You have summaries at the end of each one of these larger sections. So Samuel, it's all about Samuel in the first seven chapters. Here is the summary, verse 15. Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and he went on a circuit year by year to Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah. And he judged Israel in all of these places. Then he would return to Ramah, for his home was there, and there also he judged Israel, and he built there an altar to the Lord. So Samuel is the last of the judges. Just like John the Baptist is the last of the Old Testament prophets, Samuel is the last of the judges. Okay, his conception is miraculous. This is one of these repeating themes throughout the Bible. His conception is miraculous. His mother Hannah cannot conceive. She desperately wants to conceive. She has a wife-in-law. Is that what you would call her? Her husband is married to another woman, right? And she's giving birth all of this time. And she's having kids, and Hannah is not. And Hannah finally goes to the Lord, and she just pours out her heart, and Eli the priest thinks she's drunk, and she says, "I'm not drunk, I'm asking the Lord, and if he will just give me a child, I will bring him here to serve in the Levitical priesthood." And the Lord opens her womb, gives her a conception that is miraculous. By the way, there is another young woman who's given miraculous conception. You know her. If you read Mary's Magnificat, it is based and built upon Hannah's prayer after she has given birth to Samuel. So Mary thinks of herself as a new Hannah. And her child, she believes, is going to play a more pivotal role in Israel than Hannah's son, Samuel. Okay, so it's a really remarkable thing that you see in all of this. So the first seven chapters are all about Samuel. Now, why devote seven chapters to this guy? Given what we know about the peaks and the troughs of biblical history. Why does he come on the scene? because he's going to be the guy that will anoint David as king. Again, the book of Ruth, the book of 1 2 Samuel have a number of different characters in it, but it's all centered on David. David is the most prominent person in all of this area. The second major section is about Saul. And we have a summary of Saul's life given at the end of the section. It's chapters 8 through 14, and there is a summary of his life in chapter 14. Look at verse 50. Sorry, looking here. Chapter 14, verses 47 through 52. Here's the summary of his life. When Paul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all of his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them, and he did valiantly and struck the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered him. That sounds great, doesn't it? He's doing good things. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishvi, Malchishui, and the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merib, and the second was Michal. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul. Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. It was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he attached him to himself. That's a little foreshadowing. It's also an echo of what God had said to Israel in the law. The Lord had said through Moses, when you go into the land and you're going to look around at all the other nations, you're going to go, there's something missing. Look at the Egyptians. They have a king. The Moabites, the Ammonites, they have kings. The Philistines, they have kings. We don't have a king. And Yahweh says, it's because I'm your king. Trust in me. Depend on me. Look to me. But when you go, the temptation is going to be, we need to be like the other nations and have our own king. But let me tell you what's going to happen if you get a king. What happens when you get kings? Kings want to do what? They want money and they want sons. And why do they want both of those? They want an army. Kings want to go to war. We need to push our boundaries. I need to make my name great. And in order to do that, I need money to build up our army, and I need your young men. And God said, is that really what you want? Because you have all of the resources that you need in me. David later would write, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. The other nations need armies because they don't have me. That's what Yahweh was saying to the people. Well, just like he predicted, that's exactly what happened. And you'll remember that the rise of Saul comes because the people go, we need a king like all of the other nations that are around us. Samuel is angry about this. He's upset about this. Why do you think he's upset? It's a rejection of Yahweh, and it's also a rejection of him. And the Lord comes to Samuel and says, don't be upset. They're not rejecting you. They are rejecting me. And, you know, there's an old proverb that you should be careful what you wish for, what you ask for, because you might get it. They got it. And his name was Saul. And why did they choose Saul? Well, he looked like a king. Now, you'll remember that God also set him apart, right? So Saul is his choice, but from a particular standpoint, he's head and shoulders above everybody else. He has a regal bearing, he's a good-looking guy, and he looks like the kind of person that we want for a king. Dick Nixon, Richard Nixon, probably lost the 1960 election to John F. Kennedy because it was the first televised debate, and Tricky Dick on a black and white television had a lot of stubble. He had a thick beard. And in comparison to Kennedy, this good-looking, young, vibrant kind of guy, he didn't come across that well. If you didn't watch the screen, you just listened to the debate, I'm told, Nixon won. But it's a visual medium now, and we select people that look good. Meanwhile, the next king is going to be who? He's a good-looking guy, too. Ruddy-complected, redhead, you know. What's that? David. David isn't the oldest. David's the youngest. Which, again, if you look at the biblical storyline, happens over and over and over and over again. The ones that we would expect to be the chosen ones are not the chosen ones. That's the way it works. And so Samuel is upset. God says, don't be upset. Anoint Saul as king. And so Saul becomes king. Saul, however, and this should have been a clue that he was not really ultimately going to be God's choice. Saul came from what tribe? Benjamin. And if you go back to Jacob's final blessings on all of his sons, which tribe is going to bring forth the king? It's Judah. Judah, our old prodigal son who's come home. It's Judah, right? He's going to be the king. And so we should have known when Saul gets the throne, this isn't going to last. He's not going to be the one long term. There's got to be somebody else. And so Saul has his peak. He has his valley. He is killed. And David becomes the next. We'll talk about David next week. As we finish up 1 Samuel, we'll talk about 2 Samuel, and we'll spend the entire time talking about David. How he transitions into this role, how God places him there, his trials, his tribulations, and how ultimately he becomes the greatest of Israel's king. Great king, phenomenal leader, in many respects a really godly man, but with huge, huge flaws. Including the fact that he is just a lousy father. And it's gonna create problems for him. Okay? Any questions? All right. Go to the restroom, whatever you need to do. We'll get ready to worship here in about 12 minutes.